Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 274. Thank you for tuning in. I've got a great guest this week. It's the writer and showrunner. We will discuss what the term showrunner actually means, because you're seeing it about a lot. I'm a bit sniffly. I apologise for that. Hay fever's kicking in. But it's Jed Mercurio, who's the writer, creator, showrunner of Line of Duty, the biggest show of the year at time of recording. Bodyguard, one of the biggest shows of recent years, certainly one of the biggest new shows of recent years. Bodies and numerous other things. And we had such a good chat. It's the first time we've met, and we set it up directly, which is always really nice. It always seems to take a lot longer if you're going through a load of different people. So it was great to set it up with Jed and sit down and chat. And he was so honest and open. There's some amazing insights into all the series mentioned there. There's some insights into his transition from a doctor to one of the UK's most successful screenwriters. And again, his openness is on the table. He goes in on some some poor journalism, let's say. So yeah, it's a hell of a chat. I hope you all enjoy it. You may have noticed that there was a bonus episode on Monday. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. It's unnumbered because it's a rewind. This week or tomorrow, I don't know when you're listening to this, actually. So June 20th is World Refugee Day. And I've worked with the IRC in the past on this. I've worked with the British Red Cross in the past on this. And about 4 years ago, I think, I had a podcast where I sat down with a refugee called Ramel, and we discussed her journey and her life, and it's a hell of a conversation. So I re-released that on Monday at the start of this week. I would have released it on World Refugee Day, but because the main episode, the new episode, comes out on Wednesdays, I thought it will all get a bit lost in the mix. So I put that on Monday, and the reaction has been amazing. So thank you so much for that. If you missed it, go and have a listen. If you like this and you want to hear more from writers, I've had Kurt Sutter on, who's the writer of Sons of Anarchy, The Shield, The Bastard Executioner, and numerous others. Who else have I had on? I'm not sure. I've had loads of good people. If it's a Line of Duty thing, I've had Vicky McClure on. I've had Stephen Graham on. So I've had a good few of the Line of Duty crew. Yeah, give them a listen. My Patreon secret club got incredibly excited this week because I had another screenwriter and showrunner that I've recorded a podcast with that's coming out in a month or so, but I reveal them just after I've recorded them. I put it up. I put a photo of us up on the Patreon, which is $1 a month, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. And they were very excited about this one. But yeah, anyway, we've also have the Distraction Pieces Rewind over on patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. And this week, in fact, today, we might have just stocked the web store, speechdevelopmentrecords.com, with a certain item that we released the first limited edition run and they sold out in about an hour. So we've released one more limited edition run. It's the last one. I won't say any more than that, but you might want to head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com and to see if you're in luck. But let's get on with the podcast. It's a wonderful chat. As someone who's acting now as their primary focus, but someone who's also screenwriting as part of that primary focus, this was a hell of a podcast for me, or a hell of a conversation. The amount I learned from it was fantastic. So yeah, as I've said numerous times, as much as you guys show so much love for the podcast, there's no one who gets more out of it than me. So I appreciate you tuning in and all the love, and I hope you enjoy episode 270. What number did I say it was? 274 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Jed Mercurio.
Yeah, just dive in.
And we're firing. when the coffee arrives. It's okay. Fine. It's all it's casual podcast world.
Okay.
I'm joined today by Jed Mercurio. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
You're someone I've wanted to have on for a while, but I always think these things, it's all about timing, and now felt like the perfect timing, because the first time I was going to hit you up, it was before Bodyguard had happened, and now, if it had been a few months ago, it would have been in the mists of the Line of Duty promo period, and now we're kind of in the post Line of Duty glow, right? Because, you know, it's always been a critically acclaimed show, but for at the moment, for it to be the biggest show of the year in the UK, it must be a nice position to be in.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's great when so many people watch,
yeah.
And it's great for the team. You know, we're a pretty close-knit team. We get on very well. Those of us have been involved in it right from the beginning. So a couple of us behind the scenes, and then the regular cast,
yeah.
Martin and Vicky and Adrian. So, yeah, it's been a great journey, and to see the show still growing after all this time is incredibly pleasing.
That's exactly it. It's been that kind of amazing slow build as such that seems to have got people so hooked and so invested in it, rather than this, here's our big new show, get into it immediately. It seems to have been that people were rushing to catch up, people had been watching from day one. It feels like a labour of love in that way, because it wasn't just something that came out and had a huge marketing budget, huge push. It's just, no, we're going to keep building this on quality, and then, you know, we'll get there in the end.
That's right. I mean, we started on BBC Two.
Yeah.
So in terms of the BBC internal commissioning process, they didn't think that we stood a chance on BBC One.
Right.
I thought that we probably wouldn't find an audience. So we were very fortunate that we got an opportunity on Two and did well enough that we got recommissioned. And so it's been a slow build. And then that decision after Series 3 to move to BBC One.
Yeah.
Again, that was something that there were pros and cons to. There was a certain amount of trepidation about whether that would be successful. But it's great, you know, the fact that our audience has got bigger, that people are still invested in the show.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously people have opinions about one series versus another
of
and
course.
So on, and that's all part of the banter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it makes me think instantly of The Wire, of the kind of the critically acclaimed, yet there'll always be someone like, oh, but Series 3 is the best, or it's not as good as Series. And that always confuses me, because particularly when there's a new series, and this feels like maybe the best received series of the lot, but with so many shows, people would be like, it's good, but it's not as good as the last series. It's like, but we've seen the last series, and that's still there. Or as long as it's good and we're increasing upon the story and building the drama, that's got to be a positive. Our obsession with comparison seems like a strange thing of the social media era.
Yeah, and also I think that you've got to kind of look at those comparisons and see what lies behind them.
Yeah.
I think that when you've got easy access to opinion platforms like social media, then it means that people do want to come forward and they do want to say what they think, and that's fine. But what really gives you an insight into what the audience as a whole, the millions of people who are Line of Duty viewers, think,
yeah.
is the audience research. And I've been fortunate enough to see a document that is so top secret, I'm probably not even allowed to speak about it. But it does compare the performance of all five seasons against
yeah.
each other, against various parameters. And actually, season five does very well.
Yeah.
You know, the there are people who have said certain things about how it related to previous seasons in terms of being worse or better or whatever. Actually, the numbers are pretty flat in terms of that,
yep.
that analysis. And then there's always strong opinion towards the end about whether the last episode is a satisfying watch and,
yeah.
and fits with what's gone before. And again, the data suggests that it's the way we concluded the series is as strong a performance as in any previous season.
Yeah, yeah, completely. But there's always that urge, or now, I guess, because it's interesting, because the life of the series spans kind of pre-real social media attention. And also, I think another thing that should be taken into consideration, these things, is pre-Gogglebox, because genuinely that's a massive influence on things. I'd imagine as a creator, particularly if they're enjoying your show, to genuinely watch these people watching your show and getting excited and enjoying it. I know Vicky and Martin and a few others have all spoken how exciting it was at times that they were so hyped about it. So how's that been to watch that development as the series, or through the life of one show, I guess, so far?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think it maybe represents how TV's developed over recent years, that there are platforms that allow people to analyse TV and talk about it. And I think that's part of the fun. You know, one of the casualties of TV viewing becoming very atomised, so that overall audience figures were going down across the mainstream channels, and there was a migration towards watching box sets on streaming services where you are watching out of sync with your mates or with your family. You may be watching content that other people aren't even aware of. That ended up maybe meaning that a lot of the conversations about TV weren't as vibrant and enjoyable as they used to be.
Or the dawn of the term spoiler killed off so much conversation of film and TV. A few years back, I had a film club at the Prince Charles Cinema, and one of the points of it was we'd watch a film that I'd selected. Had nothing to do with me. I'd just selected it because I thought it was an amazing film that I'd watched on DVD or something I hadn't watched on the big screen. And then we'd discuss it afterwards because of this spoiler culture, it feels like you watch a film now and you can't talk about it to anyone, or a TV show. You can't engage and talk about it anymore because we're all watching it at different points and different times. So that takes something of the enjoyment out, I think. It should be a social thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also, when you are fortunate enough to be associated with a series that has been watched by a lot of people, and it's largely been watched in a linear fashion. So even if people aren't watching during the hour of first transmission, they're watching within 24 hours.
Yeah.
So that does create that kind of nostalgic atmosphere around TV.
Yeah, and it is one of the BBC, I think, are really good at it, because I think I love the Netflix approach of everything is there in one go and you can watch. But Line of Duty, Taboo on the BBC, which is one that I was in, so I'm biased on that. But
it was one you were in, yeah.
but they were shows that felt like people wanted to watch them on the day and talk about them. Game of Thrones is another great example. Mm. People want to either stay up or watch first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing, right? That we're going back to, or we're finding shows that have that draw and excitement, that it's like, no, I can't just watch this when I want. I need to watch it as soon as I can.
I think the trend is also that live viewing goes up towards the end of a run.
Yeah.
So in terms of the specific example of Game of Thrones, because this is the last ever season, there has been more of an impulse to watch live.
Of course,
yeah. Because it's going to be talked about more than any other season.
Yeah.
And what we find with Line of Duty is something quite similar, and same with Bodyguard, which was that at the beginning of the run, the first few episodes, there was a significant component of viewing that was post-live. And as we get towards the end of the run, particularly the last episode, the majority of the viewership is live.
Yeah. So it builds up that need and demand. I think a lot of people as well, I tried doing it myself, a lot of people like to build up a few so they've got that start of a binge. I had to stop because of a group message I'm on with Stephen Graham and a few others that suddenly blew up after a certain episode. I was like, right, I don't want to know what's happening here. So it forced my hand a bit there. I do want to talk more about Line of Duty, and a lot of people will have tuned in to hear about that, and obviously multi-award-winning, international award-winning Bodyguard. But I think talking about both of them feels like starting a box set on Series 3, because I feel a crucial part of your kind of journey as a writer, or your journey into writing as well, is Bodies, which is another series I've really enjoyed. And it feels like a great starting point, because you kind of almost accidentally came into writing. You were training as a doctor and had been in the RAF. Mm. And was it that you answered an advert or something to write for a BBC thing, and that kind of snowballed into a lifelong career of writing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had an unusual route in. I went to a very ordinary comprehensive school. No one in my family or no one I knew was remotely connected with the media.
Yeah.
So the idea that I would ever get involved in making TV seemed incredibly unlikely. And so I went into medicine. I studied science in school. It was something that I kind of enjoyed and I had an aptitude for. And then while I was at medical school, I joined the Air Force. And what I really wanted to do was aviation medicine. And it was during that period when I was in my first job as a doctor, my first house job, in Birmingham, that I saw an advert in the British Medical Journal. A TV production company were looking for advisors on a new medical series that they wanted to develop. And it just kind of triggered me in some way. You know, I was working in the early 90s in the NHS when it was pretty tough for junior hospital doctors. Yeah. And I felt that was a story that wasn't being represented in medical drama on TV back then. In fact, if you watched medical drama that was on at that time, it felt like it was representing hospital life from the 50s or 60s rather than from the 90s. So I kind of went, and I think ironically one of the things I told them was that the way medicine had been portrayed on TV was a big part of the reason that I chose to go to medical school.
Yeah.
And having started practice, I now realized that it had all been a big lie.
Yeah.
And so that was something that they were really interested in, and I was very fortunate that they helped me develop my ideas.
Yeah, it feels like the kind of thing that are one of the most popular jobs that kids want to have when they're older is being a vet, and then they get older and realize that vets is a lot of it is putting down animals. it's not this wonderful playing with animals that you think, and it's. I guess it's similar on the medical side of things. You dream that you're going to be constantly saving people, and then at the end of the day, number one, there's so many restrictions in place to allow you to do that, and number two, it's not a easy win. You know, your hit ratio isn't going to be completely in your control, so it must be a tough one to see the reality of, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's something that you only really appreciate the reality of if you do the job.
Hmm.
I think it's very hard as an outsider, even if you're something like a medical student where you're in that environment, but you're not seeing it from the exact point of view of being a house officer or a senior house officer. It's only when you drop into that job and you live it hour by hour, minute by minute, that you understand that the very particular stresses are not only on your workload, but also the relationships with other members of staff, with the nurses, the consultants, the patients, and so forth.
Yeah. How do you find, looking back at your early work as a writer, as a showrunner, as a producer? It's a weird one, because I find, from when I was doing music, all my most proud bits of my music are my most recent bits of music, and the older bits I cringe at. Yet a lot of my fan base adore those early bits. They're the bits they're attached to. Is there anything similar there with writing or show running or putting out a show?
Well, I'm actually not all that familiar with my early work in that I've kind of left it behind. It's been a long time since I've gone back and watched something that I made in, say, the first 5 years of my career. I suppose a recent exception has been Bodies, because that's been rerun on BBC iPlayer.
Yes,
so
yes, of course.
People have been talking about it, and some of the things that people were saying made me kind of curious, because I'd honestly forgotten a lot of the show.
Yeah.
So I did kind of go back, and because it's easy to access on iPlayer, I did go back and remind myself of some of it.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting experience, because a lot I'd forgotten. What I'd also say is that I think that there's an experience that a lot of us have, which is that strange kind of TV nostalgia, where we remember TV from the past, from our childhood or from young adulthood, and we imagine it being a lot better than it was.
Yeah.
And if you go back and watch a show that you watched as a kid, you're often shocked by how clunky it is.
Yeah.
So I think that's also part of the reason I tend not to revisit, because TV does move on. The technology has moved on. I think actually what I saw of Bodies, it does stand up. I mean, it does look like a modern TV show, the way it's shot and edited.
Yeah.
But I think if you went farther back in the things that I've done, they would appear to be from another era.
Yeah. Or one of the things that struck me, there's two things kind of that jump out in Bodies that feel like they would sit perfectly now. And the first is, I think it's the thing that's unavoidable as you start, is the pace of it. It's relentless. And I think that really, I'd not seen a hospital drama kind of tell that truth so clearly, that it's just relentless and high pressure. And it kind of shows that it paints a scenario where the relentlessness of the pace of working in a hospital really lends itself to mistakes being made, but the smallest mistake can be literally life or death. So I think that was a real, that felt very, because yeah, pacing in general in TV and in films has increased over the years as editing has become sharper and quicker and film has become cheaper. So was that a conscious thing to try and go, right, I want this to be almost overwhelmingly intense at the start, to say, no, this is the reality and this isn't, it's not, here's our little drama in a hospital.
I think it probably reflects what my influences were in terms of TV drama. If I look back to the TV series I was watching as a kid and as a teenager, really up until the time that I went to university, and I sort of stopped watching TV and was much more likely to go to the cinema with my mates rather than sit in and watch with my mum and dad and my brother.
It's the lack of control there, isn't it? It's watching exactly. Someone else's choice.
Yeah, I think that the shows that I really enjoyed back then were the American ones.
Yeah.
And they went at a different pace. You know, people talk about BBC drama series from the 80s. I honestly doubt I watched any of them.
Yeah.
I didn't have a great deal of affection for British TV drama. And certainly now, if I watch clips of them, I'm intrigued. But I can see that they go at a different pace from the American content. Yeah. So I think that was what I took with me when I started script writing, that I wrote short scenes with rapid transitions from one scenario to another and really wanted to propel the audience through the half hour or the hour or whatever the episode was.
Yeah. Was there any, or is there still an urge as kind of coming into this world as an outsider of sorts, of not being that, having a family who are all in TV or writing or anything like that, was there an urge to push boundaries and do things? Because one of the things that jumped out when I was a re-watching some in prep for this was, there was a scene where one of the nurses, there's a romantic situation, and one of the nurses has her period, and it's discussed. It happens. It's not a major plot point. It's just a reality. And that felt so ahead of its time, because that is, there's things like that that aren't talked about or addressed on TV and dramas. And it wasn't in there as a big plot mechanic that we're going to go off of this. It was just, oh no, sometimes people have their period and it means they can't do certain things, or can, you know, these choices. So was that a conscious decision at that stage and going forward to go, right, let's, what truths aren't being told in TV at the moment?
I think that again goes back to having, as you diagnose, an outside of you.
Yeah.
That because I didn't come up through theatre, let's say, and I didn't do any kind of filmmaking or performing in university, I wasn't moulded in that way.
Yeah.
Where I think you develop a certain kind of default position about a performing style and a writing style. And certainly early on in my career, when I encountered people who had maybe come from a more conventional background, and they did often support the idea that things should be done in the more traditional way.
Yeah.
That there are certain things you don't write about, and certain things that is kind of how we do it in TV land. So in TV land, you don't have to worry too much about authenticity. You don't have to worry about what real life is like. You're creating a different version that has its own internal logic, and people are comfortable with that, so don't mess with it.
Yeah. So do you feel, because again, it's weird because it's stuff that I'm going through at the moment, moving into acting from music, but both music and acting, I didn't have any of that in my family, any of that kind of thing. And I'm finding that thing of, I want to learn all the rules, so if I'm breaking them, it's a choice, rather than I'm breaking them out of ignorance. It's like, right, I think it can be restrictive if you've been brought into an industry in a particular way that so many people are, then it becomes a bit cookie cutter and all the same. So, but equally, if you're just there going, I'll just do it my way, then you're likely not to do it right. You're going to make mistakes that you shouldn't be making, I guess. So is that a conscious thing of learning which rules to break and which boundaries to push, and which boundaries are there, turns out, for good reason?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. When I first started writing, I learned by apprenticeship. I was writing the series, and I'd never written scripts before, so they were showing me scripts and they were giving me an insight into some fundamental rules of writing. I mean, a lot of what I wrote was modelled on TV I'd seen growing up. You know, I had, I think, an instinct for when you end a scene and the kind of moment at the end of a scene that motivates the cut to the next scene and so on. But there were times when I made what you might call rookie mistakes, and these were pointed out. And I absorbed those things, and then actually, when I got more serious about my writing, basically when the series was recommissioned and it looked like I might spend a little bit more time working in TV than I'd anticipated, I did some of those kind of workshops, sort of Robert McKee weekend screenplay writing courses, and read some books on story structure and screenwriting and all those things to try and absorb some of the principles of how you approach writing a script, how you construct story. I've now kind of reached the point where I think I'm familiar with a lot of that, but I don't think about it a lot, and
becomes instinctive.
It becomes instinctive, but I think it always remains useful as an analytical tool. If you are in a situation where you've written something and you have misgivings about it and you can't quite put your finger on what's not working, then being able to go back to the orthodox model and look at what a conventional story structure would be, that might well illuminate where you've gone wrong. It might be that you need to change the order of some events. It might be that you just need to point up which particular story beat you're aiming for in a given scene or sequence. So all those things end up being part of your toolbox.
Yeah, completely. And I think it can study such things and to test your work against such things can improve it if those adjustments need to be made, but can strengthen your resolve if you're going, oh, it should be like this, but no, it's this way for a reason. The reason I've got it like this, and it can give you that kind of, can make you find your way on a scene or anything else, because it's like, no, I've tested it now. It's not just, oh, this is how I've written it, I don't really know what I'm doing, here's how it's landing.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that it's helpful if you know that stuff, if you're unfortunate enough to encounter the structure ideologues, the people who will analyse your script and tell you that you failed to follow a conventional structure, and that sometimes is done without any understanding of where the strengths of the script lie, that they're not actually looking at something that's a really exciting moment or a really great character moment. All they want to see is the rigid enactment of story orthodoxy.
So one of the things, I'll move on from Bodies, I promise. Anyone who's tuned in and hasn't seen Bodies, it's not gonna be a whole podcast about that, but one of the things they felt like some great foreshadowing in Bodies for what was to come and be kind of amped up in Line of Duty and in Bodyguard, with the kind of the grey lines between who's the good guy, who's the bad guy. And I think there was an American series called The Shield, which was a favourite of mine, and I loved there how almost elegantly they'd switch between you're thinking these lead cops, they're the complete villains, they've crossed the line, they've gone too far, and within one scene you're like, well, they had to. Do you know what I mean? I'm on their side, or they're the good guys or bad guys. I think that comes up really delicately, constantly in Bodies, because like, I was watching it when I was rewatching some episodes recently. I was watching it with my girlfriend, and the guy that she was clearly like, he's such a bastard, he's horrible, he's the worst. I was like, well, he's kind of just made a small mistake, the same as the guy who's being presented as the good guy made a small mistake. And it depends how you address that and approach that. So, or was that a conscious effort early on to go, let's not go the traditional tropes of here's our hero, here's our villain, and they're at loggerheads?
Yeah, I think that's always been something that's been part of my approach in the last sort of 10 years or so, particularly things that are set within our public institutions, like our hospital system or our criminal justice system, that you can choose to show out-and-out villains. And actually, there are some in those institutions, but it's less dramatically interesting than showing something that I think is much more common and more troubling, which is you have people who go into those institutions for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
Idealists who become cynics, who become people who are in many ways working to oppose the values of the organization they've joined.
Yeah.
And I think with Bodies, it was important to show one very specific thing, which is that all doctors make mistakes. So rather than demonizing the guy who is the negligent surgeon, the guy who is actually a danger to patients and is being protected by the institution, it was important to humanize him.
Yeah.
Because he didn't go into medicine to harm people. It's just that certain things happened in his training and his experience and the jobs he was given that have led him to a point where the system is permitting his negligent approach to certain procedures. And I guess I felt it was really important for the lay audience to understand that there's a difference between negligence and error.
Yeah.
Sometimes I find it very problematic when there are stories of medical error in the press and there's a real kind of witch hunt to say this person shouldn't ever practice medicine, they might even have to go to prison. That really bothers me a lot. You know, a police officer can kill someone and they won't go to prison. But a doctor trying to save someone's life who makes an error of judgment, people want them to go to prison.
And
that's
who's
insane.
Having to make those judgments multiple times a day, every day. It's mind-blowing, yeah. And again, I think that's a really nice, a great way to have told that story and to get that across, to have someone that, as a viewer, you are kind of, oh, he's the worst. But then gradually, you're like, nah, well, that wasn't actually... You're now realising the way it's written and presented, I think it allows the viewer to realise their own bias, to realise that they may read that article and go, he should be put in prison.
Hmm.
And then kind of go, oh, no, actually, once you're seeing it the day in and day out, you can kind of see past that, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it's also important if you're showing an institution that they're such complex organisations that I think that you need quite complex drama to explore them.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of our medical drama and our police drama isn't very complex. It might be complex in terms of the plotting of the story of the week, but it's not very complex or sophistication in terms of its examination of the institution.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just touching upon the word complex leads us beautifully back onto Line of Duty. How much do you have to do on the research side and getting advice side of things? Because one of the things that became a meme on this series was all the abbreviations and acronyms and a few conversations that you're like, what did they just say? I thought, undercover, right, yeah, I get what that is. So how is that how's the balance between researcher and creative, I guess, in that world, in that part of script writing.
Well, we're very fortunate that we've got a couple of very good police advisors. Great. So if I'm constructing a plot and it hinges on a piece of procedure, I don't want to guess whether that happens in the real world or not, because I then don't want to have to unravel the story if it doesn't. So I will consult with them if it's a major plot point. If it's purely about detail, then I won't consult with them until there's a script and then get them to highlight any procedures they feel would happen differently. And that's also the point at which there's usually an injection of jargon where I know there are certain legal terms that police officers use, and I'm familiar with a lot of them, but there are also very specialised ones. And I want to be true to the way that police officers talk, in the way that I tried to be true to the way doctors interact with each other. And one of the things that I was very eager to achieve on my medical dramas was not to have doctors talk in a way that was like two lay people talking to each other.
Yeah.
That actually doctors speak in a highly technical language. And so my medical series had a lot of jargon in. And that's something that has got more and more part of the identity of Line of Duty.
I completely agree. Well, there's one thing that I wanted to kind of get explained, I guess, here. I swear it's a term that's only been started to be used in recent years and feels quite American, but explain the kind of role of a showrunner, because it's not simply a writer, it's not simply a producer, it's having... a greater role in both, right? And you're showrunner, I guess, for Line of Duty and Bodyguard and all these, and Bodies, I guess. So what is the role of a showrunner, or the greater role?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because the term was brought in the US to avoid the ambiguities of so many people being called executive producers.
I was going to say, all the different types of producer with executive,
you watch an American series and you look at the list of credits, and there's a dozen people who are the most senior type of producer, executive producer, but many of those have no day-to-day involvement in the series at all. So it was a way of identifying the creative leader or leaders of the project, often, and not always, but almost always, the creator of the series and the lead writer or writers. So that was something that was then borrowed for the UK system, where there'd been a much greater demarcation between writing and producing and directing. When I was first working in TV as a writer, there was a real barrier to even getting on the set or getting into casting or being in production meetings. And it took a while to break those barriers down. And Bodies was the first series where I took on a true producing role and was able to function as the showrunner, the creative leader of the project. And I've been fortunate to maintain that role on all my original series since then. So in terms of the day-to-day, it means I'm involved in all aspects of the production. So where we spend our money, who's in it, who directs it, who films it, what we shoot in a day, whether what we've shot is what we want or we need to redo any bits or add any bits, how it's edited together, how it's promoted, all those things I'm in a very fortunate and privileged position to participate in.
It's such a strange world that for so long writers were so kept out of the room as such. It's kind of all that time creating the real building blocks of all of it, and then you hand it over and find out in a year or so how it turned out. It's such a strange system to have had. You'd think the person that originally conceived it would be the perfect person to have around and have their input and have their engagement.
I mean, you're paraphrasing almost exactly what I said when I was told that I couldn't come to casting or I couldn't visit the set. That's just insane. And there were so many things that were changed or modified in some bizarre way. And what I was told was, oh, we didn't understand this line of dialogue, or we didn't, oh, we thought you meant this or that. And it's very frustrating that no one thought, well, maybe even just ask the writer, because it might actually move the discussion in the right way. And so the situation now is one where it does trouble me when I hear that writers are really excluded from the process. In fact, you know, I'd done Bodies, and I had a meeting in between Series 1 and Series 2 just before we were given a production schedule for Series 2. So I thought if there was a big delay, I might do another series. I met with a producer who appreciated that I'd been the showrunner on Bodies, but said that she would be the producer of this, and she just worked with a director who she wanted to bring on board, and he didn't like the writer being in the room when they were doing casting. And I was just thinking, this is just insane. I'm just never going to work for you people or work with you people. Yeah. Because I just think that's unacceptable. And it still goes on. You know, even very successful, very high-profile writers find themselves at times excluded from the production. That decisions are made without their knowledge. Sometimes there's almost a conspiracy to keep the writer out of the loop, because it might be irritating if they have a view that disagrees with everyone. Yeah. Whereas I'm not involved in those conversations because I want to impose my rigid view on everyone. I just want to be in those conversations because it may be that I've got an insight or a contribution that they aren't aware of.
Yeah.
And that will just then make everyone able to make the most informed decision about what the right thing to do in that moment is.
And that's it. It's making the most informed decision rather than imposing anything. There was I worked on American's series at one point, and it was filming over here, but the writers were in the US. And there was such a fear of going anywhere slightly off script. And I think if you've got the right team, often they can be some of the greatest moments when the actor who's got to know that specific character and that character only for 5-6 episodes, 2-3 seasons or whatever, can put in a bit of their own input. But if the writer was there, and again, knowing who the writers were, knowing that they were creatives and up for collaboration... Mm. If they were there, there would have been a discussion and stuff would have changed. Because they weren't, it was constantly this rigid, here's the dialogue. Stick exactly to that. So I think the benefit of having the writer there, it goes both forwards and backwards. It gives that flexibility on both sides. And when I had Simon Pegg on, he had examples, and I've heard Charlie Brooker talk of this, of some bits, because of something that's coming on later, it's key that it has to be that way. And if the writer can briefly explain that, then that's great, and you can move on, and it's done. Whereas if it seems that it's this note that you cannot change this, then it's going to often breed a bad atmosphere and a bad response.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think the important thing is to be available. That if you feel that nothing should change, but then you're not available for discussion, then I think that's not collaborative.
Yeah.
And so you're as guilty as the people who change things unilaterally without referring to the writer at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And those examples of things where something is important to the overall arc and no one's noticed it, the director has missed it, or the actor saying the line doesn't realise that that does relate to something that happened in a previous episode or a future episode. You can get in the situation where it just doesn't get filmed. It's not even that they film it and then do a take without it in, or they film it and say, well, if it doesn't work, we can always cut it in post. It ends up some weird kind of workshop that gets filmed that maybe doesn't bear any relationship to the way the scene was originally conceived. So there are plenty of stories out there from writers who've had that experience, and I certainly had that experience early on, where sometimes the decision to change something was so arbitrary and at times just so thick-headed that you kind of wonder why that runaway train was even allowed to happen. I mean, I remember doing a series very early on, and the there was a scene that was written as a day scene, and the director felt it would look more atmospheric to shoot it at night, but they didn't change the dialogue. So all the dialogue related to things that happened during the day, and the audience knows those things happened during the day. Oh, wow. But it was like no one even cared. It was extraordinary.
Yeah. That's mad to hear. You touched upon, or a couple of times you touched upon the casting part of it, and I think casting directors and casting with showrunners involved as well is one of the most overlooked parts of the industry. I think it's no mistake that some of, or most of the biggest and best TV shows in recent years have been full of cast that up until that point you didn't particularly know them. There weren't these huge names. Mm. I think Game of Thrones is a prime example. A Line of Duty as well. In those early days, people, obviously, Vicky had done This Is England, stuff like that, but never in that kind of role. And I think it really makes a massive difference, and it gets overlooked. How is that? How do you find working with casting directors? It's Kate Rhodes James on Line of Duty, right, who I've had two good castings with and one awful one, so I can't decide. I need to get one more good one just to really know I've got her on side. How do you find that, and how important is it, and how frustrating can it be when you're trying to find the character that you've written in the real world?
Yeah, I think casting is one of those things that is possibly one of the most difficult things, because you can't ever get away from the human factor. Every actor is different. Yeah. Every actor will perform an audition slightly differently. And once you've got someone cast in a role, then that's when the hard work really begins in terms of developing the detailed approach to each scene and the character arcs. So the most important thing is to have that right level of collaboration. So what you're looking for is to create someone who's right for the role, but also someone who is a good fit for the rest of the cast. You know, it is kind of a balancing act. You can get someone who's absolutely perfect for a role, but they kind of skew the whole show towards that role, and maybe they unbalance things, and it can end up being quite a complicated thing to come up with a whole cast who fit together very well. In terms of my approach to auditions, I generally want to see people who come in very well prepared. It frustrates me, an actor coming in who hasn't studied the material, even if they're just auditioning for a short scene that's maybe a page or half a page. They don't know the lines. They're just looking down at the script all the time. Yeah. I'm just not going to cast them.
It's mad, because that's my outlook in my limited time in this industry is that's the one bit you've got control of as an actor, of learning the lines. All the rest of it, you've got no control. It can be so much on first impression.
Yeah.
As you said, the connecting with other people in the already cast. So, yeah, it blows my mind that the one bit that you can control is knowing your lines and going in and doing what you can do. Again, here you go, I can do this. So it's mind-blowing that's still something that gets... And again, also being aware that there's so many people after every single role. Yeah. So again, to be that casual on something is a...
Well, it's career suicide.
Yeah.
You know, it's we just wouldn't see them again for any role.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if someone comes in and they've worked really hard, if they're not right for that specific role that they're auditioning for, then you keep them in mind. And if you really warm to someone and they're very clearly working hard and they're committed to their craft, then you're going to want to find a role for them because of the kind of person that you want to work with.
Is that a key part as well? I mean, you touched upon the family of you, Vicky, Martin, Adrian, and a few others behind the scenes. Is it because something else I've noticed from Bodies to Line of Duty to Bodyguard, there's some return players. You've worked with a lot of similar people. Is that a key part? Number one, knowing that someone can do the job that you need them to do. But number two, knowing that you can be around them, can enjoy them on set, that they're not going to bring a bad atmosphere or any baggage. Is that a key part as well? Because it was weird, and I always go in end up going into this story, it seems. But when I was on Taboo, originally my role was tiny, but because I'm on this outsider thing as well, every time I'd be wrapped, I'd ask if I can stay and watch, because I'm learning from Stephen Graham and Tom Hardy and all these amazing people. And that willingness to be on set, to be around, to learn, is what made the character end up growing and growing, because they'd be like, oh, well, Pip's here still, let's sling him in another scene, or get him in this, or get him in that kind of thing. So it felt that that eagerness and warmth on set had as much to do with my success on that role as what I did on camera, if you know what I mean. So is that a balance that you have to take into account there?
Yeah, I think so. I think that you're always making a bit of a leap into the unknown working with anyone, because as I said, the way in which someone will portray a character is often quite unpredictable.
Yeah.
And if you are kind of looking for certain things that you can rely on, then basic things like having a strong work ethic, always being prepared for the scenes, being someone who, when they're on set, is a team player, someone who also will help you by pointing out things within the script that they think need more work, but do it in the right way. All those things are incredibly helpful towards doing the best quality production possible.
Yeah.
So often when I'm working on something new, there will be lists of actors generated for the various roles, and on those lists will be mainly people I've never worked with before, but one or two people that I have worked with before. And it's really about finding the balance between not typecasting, not picking someone who is maybe too easy a choice, but also working with people who you know are going to be there working hard all through the process. Because, you know, we all have our ups and downs in a production. Some days are easy, some days are tough. Some days an actor's got a lot of prep they need to get through, and other days they only have a couple of lines and it's a relatively easy day.
Yeah.
So you need to know that you've got people who are going to deliver.
Yeah, I mean, and those relatively easy days are just as telling, right? And just as important, because if you've not got much to do, that can be when people's minds will wander frustrations will build. So, yeah, that must be key. I mean, you touched upon unknown elements. You've obviously got this amazing core cast, and I want to sling Craig Parkinson in there as well, because he was fantastic for ages. I feel I've left him out there. It kept coming to mind. But you've also had some amazing kind of one series kind of great people, from Tandy Newton, Danny Mays, Keely Halls, and Stephen Graham in this last season. How do you find that, kind of bringing someone into the fold, often aware that they're only there for a temporary time, and it's got to be that balance of them not overwhelming the balance, quite literally the balance, but also having enough about them to be able to be dropped in and have an impact and leave again or stick around?
Yeah, I think it's easier now with Line of Duty than it used to be, because we have built up a body of work. So I think people who are at the level of, say, a Stephen Graham or a Tandy Newton are kind of aware of what they're coming into.
Yeah.
So we can have a very informed and helpful conversation about how the character is going to fit into an established world. Because they can see the preceding seasons, they can see the acting style of Martin and Vicky and Adrian, although obviously, you know, Stephen was hugely familiar with them because he'd worked with all of them before. Yeah. So that ends up being part of it. And also, you know, I also value the opinion of the regular cast. I if there's someone who is available and interested in playing our guest lead, then I'll always have a chat to Martin and Vicky and Adrian and say, is this someone you've worked with before? What do you think? And if they said, oh, no, they're a lunatic, or oh, they're awful, then we wouldn't cast them.
Again, that just knowing now, That must have been the easiest conversation with Stevie then. They said he'd worked with all of them.
Yeah.
He'd got on with all of the Gunnings. Yeah. It's like, no, it's all good.
Yeah, it kind of felt when Stephen joined the series, it was like, why weren't you here to begin with? It's yeah, like, he's such a great fit. And yeah. And Craig the same. I mean, Craig had done a lot with Martin and Vicky before.
Yeah.
And that's no accident. It's because they have similar acting styles. And if you were casting a film or a TV series, then you can see them being a good blend because yeah, they appear to come from the same world.
Yeah, yeah, that makes complete sense. Well, I mean, we're getting towards the hour mark, so I'll start to wrap things up. But I want to kind of talk about how different it was when the body... Not the Bodyguard, when Bodyguard came out. I'm being very careful not to get the on there. Because, as I said, you'd had this experience of the slow build, long game, of Line of Duty, of developing these characters slowly, of, even as we said, of having the attention elsewhere for the early points. Do you know what I mean? So you can find your characters and find where it's all going. Bodyguard was straight away huge attention, huge pressure. Thankfully, huge praise and excitement and tension. But how was that as a project to run and put out there?
Yeah, I mean, the origin of Bodyguard was actually because Line of Duty was on BBC Two.
Yeah.
And going back to around the time we were doing Series 3, it seemed like it was going to stay on BBC Two. And that also meant probably we didn't have much of a future because BBC Two tends not to do long-running, returning series. So there was an appetite from the BBC to do a thriller that could play on BBC One.
Yes.
So the whole development process on Bodyguard was to create something that would be more mainstream and have more immediate impact. And that doesn't mean that there was any kind of sacrifice of artistic values. It was purely that the choices you make about how the story starts, what the premise is,
yeah, sure.
it had to be something bigger and more immediate than the premise for Line of Duty. And obviously we were incredibly fortunate that we got that great cast.
Yeah.
I think that the premise plus those actors plus the trailer really helped bring the audience. I think that the audience was able to grasp what was being offered, and that's why they came. And I think we were very fortunate that we delivered on expectation in the first couple of episodes.
Yeah.
And that then created the momentum that carried us through to the end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cast is a great thing to highlight because it was a perfect balance of, there were some big names in there, but there weren't any celebrities as such. They were all big names for what they've done previously for their body of work, and that just it's weird because it did launch so big, but then again you go through, you're like, well, there's not this big Hollywood star attached to it in any way, but it was it felt like,
well,
a
there
great
is
balance
now
there.
Obviously
of course. So with that, how did you find, again, the immediacy then equally means there'll be the immediate critique and criticism and backlash? And I enjoyed watching you deal with a lot of it on social media and stuff like that. But how do you find that? Because there's that kind of that human defense mechanism, or it's supposedly a survival mechanism that we remember the negative far easier than we remember the positive. And I know it from my own life on social media that you can have all these reviews saying it's amazing, and then one prick on Twitter will say, well, you're technically, you should have done this, and that'll be the one that sticks in your mind. How have you found that, and how do you balance that in the kind of addressing it or walking away from it? Or
I think if people are expressing their opinion, then it doesn't really bother me because I can go and look at something that is much more valuable information, which is the audience research. So a newspaper review or a blog or whatever it is one person's opinion.
Yeah.
And largely that has no value in itself. I think what has value is data that originates from the behaviour of thousands of people, so yeah. It can be much more robust. You can draw much more robust conclusions from it. So the audience research on Bodyguard was telling me positives all the way through, that in terms of not just what the viewing figures were, but how much people liked each episode. That's also part of the audience research that we get. So I certainly felt very happy with how it had performed. So a bad opinion piece doesn't bother me. What I do take issue with is someone either lying or distorting facts or inventing facts as the platform for their argument. So I will challenge that.
Yeah.
It's like someone going on Twitter to claim the earth is flat or that vaccinations cause autism. You've got to challenge that.
Yeah.
So if someone does, like, I mean, examples are, I mean, for the recent series of Line of Duty, there was a reviewer who said the plot twists were preposterous and then invented something that had never happened as his argument. So I challenged that. There was a reviewer who said the plot was too complicated to follow and then gave some examples of things that he thought were puzzling and bizarre and didn't fit together, and just made a complete tit of himself because he'd missed things that the audience got very easily.
Yeah.
And then there's that kind of thing where people do the backhanded compliments where they say it's full of plot holes, but they don't. I mean, this guy who did talk about the plot holes just scored so many own goals because he actually laid out for everyone to see what a fucking idiot he is.
Yeah, it was all there.
Yeah, whereas usually what they say is it's full of plot holes, but then they never identify one, because they know if they do, they run the risk of it being revealed that they've either misunderstood something or they've completely missed something.
Yeah.
So those are the things I'll challenge. And any distortion of fact, anyone who says that this wouldn't happen in the real world when there's plenty of evidence that it would.
Yeah.
Often those people have an agenda. So with Bodyguard, a lot of so-called bodyguards in real life came out of the woodwork, but they were people who weren't specialist protection officers in the police. They were people who were bodyguards for hire for celebrities.
Right.
So they don't use police training methods. They're not police officers, so they have no responsibility to uphold the law. Their job is to protect their client. So often those criticisms were invalid. But what's also going on is that I know that media editors are instructing so-called journalists to write a piece which is slagging the show off, and go and find a bodyguard or someone who purports to be a bodyguard to slag it off. And this happened on my medical shows. They'll ask a doctor, is this right? And the doctor will say, yeah, okay, well, we won't use you. Ask the next guy, is this right? Yeah, we won't use you. Ask the next guy, is this right? No, right, we'll use you. That's the way it works.
Yeah,
and I just think that needs to be called out when it happens. And also, you know, a lot of the journalism is that kind of smug, elitist, if it's popular, it must be crap kind of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, again, I think that's, I think the clickbait mentality of journalism has found its way off of the internet. You know, off of clicks. It's kind of, it's gone everywhere, and there can be that kind of, oh, we need to just be contrarian, essentially, just because I'm not knowledgeable if I'm enjoying something that everyone's enjoying. It removes my expertise.
Yeah, I think you've got to look at the kinds of people who write reviews. You have the sort of tabloid end, and what they're looking for is the sensationalist story. Yeah. They're looking for a bit of clickbait. They're looking to show a picture of one of the actresses with no clothes on, or whatever horrible, tawdry thing that they particularly want to do. Yeah. Then you have the broadsheet end, and they're fundamentally people who've got the job because of people they know.
Yeah.
So they went to the right university, but they're fundamentally a bit thick.
Yeah.
So there's just some posh twat who's got the job, and that puts them in a position where they can be really smug and snide and slag off people who work very hard, who've earned the position they're in.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. It kind of goes back to, it came to mind when you were talking about doctors and how they're trying their best to save someone's life, and sometimes an error is made. I think a friend of mine, Brett Goldstein, who's an actor and has got a film podcast, is a writer. We talk a lot about how we both generally just rave about the stuff that we like online, because there's an awareness that no one has set out to make a bad film or a bad TV show or a bad or whatever else. And it's bizarre to have the arrogance to swarm on stuff like that and try and attack and try and make these things.
I think, again, going back to how I started this answer when we opened up this subject, there's a difference between opinion and fact.
Yes.
So I can look at an opinion and decide from that the person who holds that opinion is a word beginning with C. Yeah. But I don't need to challenge it because it's their opinion. It's where they appear to be dealing in the currency of facts, but they're not.
Yeah.
So they're distorting facts or they're disputing things which are true. That's what needs to be challenged. So when that goes on in reviews where, I mean, going back to my medical shows, the right-wing press wanted to slag off the shows, so they wrote articles about how certain things in it were wrong, as if someone who works in Fleet Street knows more about being a junior hospital doctor than I did when I was a junior hospital doctor.
Yeah.
That's offensive to me.
Yeah.
And the same applies now when you have these journalists who do no fact-checking. They just write something like police officers think line of duty is ridiculous because Cressida Dick said it was ridiculous, who doesn't own a TV and doesn't understand that it's a series about an anti-corruption unit. So their job is to find find police corruption.
Yeah.
That's why there's police corruption in it.
Yeah.
So it's things like that do irritate me. And I do find that social media is a useful tool to be able to put out what I hope is factual correction of these distortions.
Yeah, that's great to have that platform as a right to reply as such. I'll round things up now on two things. Just one that comes to mind. It feels Line of Duty and Bodyguard had this, and I think it was also a big effect on Peaky Blinders, that the moment they got onto a Netflix, or basically found their way to an American audience, was the moment it kind of seemed to ramp up a whole other level. It seemed to be this whole new jump up in the stakes, I guess, but more than anything, the excitement around it. Did you find that, and how's that been, and has that influenced how you approach anything or the way you want to tell a story? I said you already have said that your influences were always the American ways of making TV. So how has that been to get that praise on that side of the Atlantic?
Yeah, I mean, that's been great. I would say that Bodyguard's kind of found a relationship with the American audience that my other works haven't so far. So although Line of Duty and actually Bodies were shown in the US and did get really positive reviews, they never reached that sort of point of critical mass when they became a bona fide hit.
Yeah.
Whereas with Bodyguard, because of the reach of Netflix, and also I think maybe the style of the show, it's really worked for the American audience, and it does go back to my influences, the fact that I love American TV. I love their confidence in showing action, their real commitment to having a really driving narrative that propels the audience through the viewing experience. All those things, I think, have contributed to the great response we've got.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I'll wrap things up by just asking, what's ahead, I guess? More Line of Duty. Is it that, are you in that situation where everything's going so well, you've got no time to think about any other ideas or options or plans, or yeah, what's the...
I mean, I wouldn't say that things are going so well that I'm resting on my laurels. I mean, I think we're very fortunate to be in this position with Line of Duty, where we knew we had a Series 6 before we did Series 5.
Great.
So that's there for us either to round off the series, or if we're fortunate enough to do a Series 7 to carry on. And those are conversations we're having at the moment with the BBC, and also internally,
yeah,
about when we might be ready to shoot again, and that depends on the availability of the team, the cast, and so on. And the same with Bodyguard. So there will definitely be more Line of Duty, we know that. And so at the moment, I'm kind of looking at my schedule. If we get into Line of Duty or Bodyguard 2 very quickly, then I think I'll just roll straight into doing those. But if there's a significant delay for whatever reason, then I'd like to do a project in the interim.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure, and it's flown by. So thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, Pip.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Jed Mercurio. I'm going to keep this outro short. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week. Who have I got on next week? Let me have a look on my phone. I've recorded such good ones lately. While I'm looking, I'd recommend you check out the Pod Bible. The Pod Bible is a podcast magazine that is free. It's available online digitally, or you can collect physical copies from various places in London and Brighton. I've just looked, and next week's guest is the one that I was teasing in the intro. So I'll tell you now, for the few who stick around right until the end, next week I'm joined by Charlie Brooker. Yeah, it's exciting, isn't it? Wonderfully exciting. Great to have Charlie on. So if all goes to plan, this week, next week, and the week after are three of the best, most critically acclaimed British screenwriters ever. So it's a hell of a run if you're into that kind of thing, and I hope you are. So I'll see you all next week. Patreon.com/ScroobiusPip if you want in on that goodness, and to find out who the third of these three I'm hyping is. Other than that, I'll see you next week with Charlie Brooker. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.